Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're digging into something that, well, it feels like it touches almost everyone in the working world right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's this idea of moving towards a skills-first approach. We're basing this on a working paper from Singapore's Institute for Adult Learning, and it asks a really direct question. Skills first, are we there yet?
Yeah, and that question gets right to the core, doesn't it? How do we actually value what people can do in the job market? Is it still all about that degree, that certificate?
Or are we really genuinely shifting focus to, you know, skills you can see and proficiency someone actually has?
Exactly.
So our mission here is to unpack this paper. We want to understand what skills first really means, like in practice.
And crucially, what are the big roadblocks? Why isn't it happening everywhere already if it sounds like a good idea?
Right. What are the hurdles and what's being done? We'll look globally and specifically at Singapore to see what kind of solutions are being tested.
And prepare for some potentially surprising insights, because the reasons we seem to be stuck are often pretty deep structural, even cultural. It's not just about launching more training courses.
Yeah, it's about changing how we fundamentally see capability, isn't it?
That's a big part of it.
So this deep dive, it's really for you. If you're navigating your career, wondering how to position yourself.
Or if you're an employer trying to build the best team, especially now with things changing so fast.
Or even if you're just curious about where the world of work is heading. Let's jump right in.
Okay, so the paper starts by kind of setting the scene historically, how we thought about credentials versus skills over time.
Right. So think back, maybe, I don't know, pre-2000s mostly. Yeah. The main model was what the paper calls qualification-centric.
Totally. Your formal education, your degree, that was the primary signal. That piece of paper was basically the gatekeeper.
Then maybe starting around the 2000s, we see these skills-based hybrids emerge.
Yeah, we started talking about competencies, skills, trying to integrate them into the existing systems.
But, and this is key, right? The qualifications, the degrees, they were still kind of dominant. Skills were often just like listed alongside the degree.
Exactly. They weren't the main event. Which brings us to the goal, the aspiration, the skills first model.
This is where what you can do, your actual skills, your proficiency, that becomes the main currency.
The primary way you get hired, get promoted. Qualifications might still matter, but they play more of a supporting role.
And the paper stresses this needs a big shift, right? Like system-level coordination, education, industry, government, all needing to work together differently.
And that's the core question the paper wrestles with. Can skills actually be that main currency? Can people build careers on them? And can employers effectively use skills to find talent?
It helps to look back at the attempts. The paper walks through this evolution, mentioning things like competency-based training back in the 80s and 90s.
Oh, yeah, that was a big push. Places like the UK with NVQs, National Vocational Qualifications, trying to define jobs by what people needed to be competent at. Australia had similar things.
But they ran into problems pretty quickly, didn't they?
They did. The paper points out criticisms like sometimes reducing complex jobs down to just a checklist of tasks. Kind of missing the bigger picture.
And employer buy-in wasn't great.
Surprisingly low. By 1990, the paper says something like only 14% of UK firms were actually using NVQs in their recruitment.
Wow.
Yeah. And there was confusion, too. What does competence really mean? Is it just ticking a box or something more? Assessment was often seen as too rigid, just pass-fail.
And skills learned in one place didn't always transfer easily somewhere else.
Exactly. So Singapore had its own early version, the National Skills Recognition System, NSRS, launched in 99. They learned from the UK and Australia.
But faced similar issues.
Pretty much. Employers found it bureaucratic. Workers sometimes felt the NSRS certs weren't, you know, as prestigious as a degree.
And the assessment plans, often set by the government, were seen as too rigid by the training providers themselves. They couldn't adapt easily.
Right. A World Bank evaluation pointed that out specifically. That rigidity really hurt adoption.
So it didn't hit its targets.
No. And that led to major reforms like the Workforce Skills Qualifications, WSQ system in 2005. That was designed to be more modular, flexible, bring employers in more.
And that kept evolving, didn't it? Towards a national skills framework and this push for national job skills intelligence using data more.
Yeah, trying to get clearer definitions, integrate technical skills with those softer generic skills, and just get wider buy-in.
But even with all that evolution, the paper's pretty clear.
Yeah.
There are still ongoing challenges.
Definitely. That early skepticism, like NVQs being seen as second best, that lingers. assessment is still tricky. How do you capture real performance nuances?
And that fragmentation problem, different definitions, different frameworks, it hasn't completely vanished.
No. Plus, you've got institutional resistance sometimes. Universities, for instance, can be slow to fully embrace these skills-based models.
And a really crucial point the paper makes, which you mentioned earlier, is that so many reforms focus on the supply side, the training.
Right. But the bottleneck is often on the demand side, getting employers to actually change how they hire and value people based on skills. Without that demand shift, even the best frameworks struggle.
Okay, so that leads us perfectly into the core of the paper, really. These five big interconnected structural barriers that are slowing down this whole skills-first shift.
Yeah, these are the really deep-rooted issues. First one, signaling failures.
Right, let's break that down. The basic problem is it's hard for an employer to know for sure what skills a candidate has, right? It takes time. It costs money.
Screening costs, the paper mentions, can be like 14% of salary for smaller companies. That's significant.
So what do employers do? They use shortcuts. Proxies. And the easiest, most common proxy is still often that formal degree.
It's imperfect. Everyone knows that, but it's a quick signal.
And the stats here are quite stark. One study on soft skills certification. Candidates with the cert were 23% more likely to get hired. Sounds good.
But only 12% of the companies actually adopted the certification afterwards. They just reverted to old habits, maybe found it too much hassle.
That's telling. And the paper also cites research suggesting maybe 20% to 40% of the extra pay someone gets for a degree isn't about what they learned.
But just the degree acting as a signal. Why?
Exactly. Just signaling something to the employer.
And you see this in Singapore, too. LinkedIn surveys show people think degrees are less vital, but employers' HR departments, they still lean on them.
And that study you mentioned earlier, dropping degree requirements, only resulted in, what, less than 4 extra non-degree hires per 100 jobs?
Yeah, a tiny number. It shows the gap between saying you value skills and actually changing hiring practices.
It's not just degrees either. There's this explosion of other credentials, right? Mm-hmm. Like over 1 million in the U.S. alone.
But most lack clear validation. So if you're an employer, how do you sort through that? It's overwhelming. Only about 1 in 8 actually lead to higher wages, apparently.
The paper uses this great analogy. Companies manage their physical supply chains meticulously.
But their talent supply chains are way behind. They often don't even have good tools to define the skills they need, let alone see the skills they have in their workforce.
Which leads right into the second barrier, coordination deficits.
Yeah, this is all about fragmentation. Everyone's speaking slightly different languages. Employers, educators, policymakers.
How so?
Well, educators might talk about learning outcomes and credits. Employers talk about job tasks and performance goals. Policymakers talk about frameworks and funding. They're not always aligned.
It makes it hard to connect the dots. The paper mentions IBM's internal digital badges, great within IBM.
But they didn't travel well outside because IBM's way of defining skills didn't easily map onto other systems.
Right. The paper talks about this skills value chain, defining skills, getting skills, showing skills, getting recognized for skills. And there are breaks all along that chain.
A big piece is just the lack of shared infrastructure for data. Training records are over here. Job market data is over there. Getting a complete picture is tough.
Okay, barrier number 3 feels very human. Risk asymmetry.
Totally. It's about incentives or lack thereof. Employers worry. If I invest in training this person, what if they just leave and go to my competitor?
Poaching fears.
Exactly. The paper notes risk-averse managers are like 30% less likely to fund general skills training. They prefer company-specific stuff. And hiring someone based on credentials feels safer than betting on skills demonstrations that might be harder to verify.
And it's risky for workers too, isn't it?
Absolutely. Why should you spend time and money on training if you're not sure it'll be recognized or lead to a better job or pay?
Especially for people maybe with fewer resources to start with.
Right. Financial constraints, uncertainty about the payoff, it makes participation harder, even if the skills would be beneficial.
So the paper asks, how can policy help individuals manage their careers better? And what really motivates employers to invest in developing talent, not just consuming it?
Good questions. Which leads to the fourth barrier, maybe the most technically challenging, measurement gaps.
The productivity black box, as the paper calls it.
Yeah. It's just really hard to quantify the actual impact of specific skills on things like productivity or innovation.
The paper breaks this down into 4 types of gaps. First, valuation deficits. We just lack standard ways to measure skill value.
That WEF stat is telling. 83% of employers say skills are key, but only 11% actually measure the productivity impact.
Wow. Second, attribution challenges. Skills work together, right? It's hard to isolate the impact of just one skill.
One study found typical metrics only capture about a quarter of the performance difference that's actually driven by skills.
Third, equivalence obstacles. Different frameworks, different definitions. It's like trying to compare apples and oranges or different currencies without an exchange rate.
And if you don't have that common language, that common measure, what happens? People fall back on the old proxy, the degree.
And fourth, the economic transition. We're in this knowledge economy, but we don't understand its productivity drivers as well as we understood, say, factory output. It makes measuring intangible skills even harder.
It's fascinating that standard accounting rules, GAAP, don't even recognize human capital or training ROI as assets on the balance sheet. They're just expenses.
So if skills aren't visible there, how can their value be fully grasped?
Exactly. Without better measurement, sticking with credentials feels easier, safer. The paper asks, what are the first steps? Maybe adopting things like human capital reporting standards.
Okay, the fifth and final barrier. This one feels deeper. Cultural resistance.
Yeah, this is subtle but powerful. It's about societal norms. For generations, we've equated academic credentials with intelligence, with merit, with employability. It's deeply ingrained.
And you see it in hiring, right? Managers often hire people like themselves, educationally speaking.
That unconscious bias. And remember that burning glass stat again.
Mm-hmm.
Dropping the degree requirement barely moved the needle on hiring non-grads. That shows the gap between policy and actual cultural practice.
Credentials end up signaling things like trainability or maybe fitting in as much as actual job skills.
And individuals play into this too. Even if getting skills seems more direct, pursuing a degree often feels like the safer, more recognized path.
Despite stats showing lots of graduates are underemployed or that some non-grads out-earn them.
Yeah. The paper asks, are we conditioned to undervalue skills? Or is it just the competitive job market pushing us towards the safer credential strategy? Probably a bit of both.
Without that broad social acceptance, that clear evidence that skills alone are valued and rewarded, the pull towards traditional credentials is just really strong.
It really is.
Okay, so those are the five big challenges. It sounds daunting.
It is. But the paper doesn't stop there. It also highlights some promising skills-first interventions examples of things being tried to tackle these specific barriers.
Okay, good. Let's hear about some solutions, or at least attempts. What about for signaling?
Well, things like the Digital Credentials Consortium, DCC, they're working on open standards for digital credentials. So they're verifiable, trustworthy, and can work across different systems.
Making them more portable and reliable.
Exactly. Or New Zealand's micro-credential framework. It gives institutional backing to shorter learning chunks, making them stackable and hopefully more recognizable to employers.
And for coordination, that's speaking the same language problem.
There's the EU's ESCO framework. It's this massive effort to create a common classification of skills, qualifications, and occupations across Europe, like a multilingual dictionary for the labor market.
Ambitious.
Very. And there's also SFIA, the skills framework for the information age. It's industry-led, global, trying to map digital skills consistently. But like ESCO, getting widespread adoption is still a challenge.
What about risk asymmetry? Helping employers and workers feel safer investing in skills.
Sweden's job security councils are a fascinating example. They're funded collectively by employers, a small payroll contribution. They pool the risk and actively help workers who are laid off to transition and retrain.
So it's not all on one company's shoulders.
Right. And internally, companies like Zurich Insurance have programs like My Journey or My 70% that encourage employees to use skills on projects outside their main job, often funded through internal cost sharing, reduces the risk for individual managers.
Interesting. And measurement that black box.
Big picture, you have things like the OECD's PIAAC study. It directly tests adult skills, literacy, numeracy, problem solving across many countries, and links those skills to actual employment and wage outcomes, gives real data.
And at a company level.
PwC's internal skills first strategy is a great case study. They use tech to match people to roles and projects based on skills. The pilot apparently cut hiring time dramatically, boosted internal mobility, increased training uptake.
And productivity.
They estimated millions in gains from an internal gig marketplace. Plus, it improved hiring diversity, more women, more people from non-traditional backgrounds. Shows what's possible when you really focus internally on skills.
And finally, tackling cultural resistance.
Efforts like the American Opportunity Index, AOI, try to shift norms by publicly benchmarking companies on how well they promote employee mobility, often tied to skills.
And companies themselves making bold moves.
Like IBM's new color hiring, publicly saying skills matter more than degrees for many roles. Over half their U.S. jobs now don't require a four-year degree. And their Skills Build platform offers free training, directly challenging the old pathways.
So the paper then connects these ideas back to Singapore's specific efforts under Skills Future.
Yeah, it maps Singapore's initiatives against those five barriers. So the national skills taxonomies and job portals. That's about improving signaling.
Okay, and things like skill development partners or the new job skills integrators.
Aimed at better coordination between industry and training providers.
Makes sense. The grant Skills Future credit for individuals, enterprise credit for companies.
That's clearly about de-risking the investment in skills and training.
What about measurement or impact?
Initiatives focused on workplace learning, like Centers of Excellence or the Skills Future Queen Bees program, where lead companies help others improve, that's trying to show the impact of skills on the job.
And general outreach, roadshows.
Trying to shift cultural acceptance, getting everyone more comfortable with the idea of skills being central.
But the paper's verdict is still...
Still not there yet. Singapore's doing a lot, making significant efforts. But like everywhere else, those deep structural and cultural barriers mean it's an ongoing process of building and refining.
So wrapping this all up, the big message from the paper seems to be that getting to skills first isn't just about launching another program.
No, it's much bigger than that. It requires structural realignment, changing how the systems work, and also cultural transformation, changing mindsets.
It's about building an entire ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
Not just fixing one part in isolation.
Exactly. All the players have a role. Individuals need to learn and, crucially, signal their skills effectively. Employers need to change how they hire, develop talent, and actually value skills in practice.
Training providers need to make sure their programs really deliver relevant competencies and assess them well.
And policymakers need to provide the right infrastructure, the incentives, the coordination, and help shape that public narrative around the value of skills.
It's definitely a long-term commitment. Requires collaboration, trying things out, learning as you go.
And maybe those hybrid models where skills and qualifications work together are a necessary stepping stone for a while.
Yeah. It's just such a complex challenge hitting these really deep norms and systems, but hugely important for careers, for companies, for the whole economy.
Absolutely.
So the paper leaves us and you, the listener, with some pretty direct questions to think about. Like, what assumptions about value, merit, capability do you need to maybe reevaluate?
In your own life, your own work context, whether that's planning your career or hiring people or just how you think about learning.
And how do your actions, maybe even unconsciously, fit into this bigger picture? Are you reinforcing the old ways, or are you finding ways to value skills more?
It makes you think.
And maybe the most practical question, what's one small step you could consider taking? Maybe documenting your own skills better on LinkedIn, or asking about skills-based hiring where you work, or exploring learning that's not a traditional degree.
It really brings it home that this isn't just policy talk. It's something that involves all of us, requires a shift from the ground up, too.
Definitely a lot to mull over there.
Mm-hmm.
This deep dive really shows that while skills first sounds great on paper,
the reality of getting there is incredibly complex, thanks to the inertia of how things have always been done and the subtle but strong influence of culture.
Yeah. Making skills the real currency, the main currency of opportunity. It seems like it needs a fundamental collective shift in how we see, measure, and connect what people can do.
A huge undertaking, but potentially transformative if we can get there.